Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And for over 300 episodes, there have been many different types of people that I keep saying the royal we, but it's really just me with this show. But I count you in, my listener friend. I count you in on this. So I will continue to say we. So the main thing that we really celebrate here are so many different various creatives. If you are an author, we celebrate you. If you are a screenwriter, we celebrate you. If you are a professor, we celebrate you. If you are a publisher, a producer, a director, filmmaker of any kind, we celebrate you. And so it's only right that we have Autumn Karen as the guest this week, because she is all of that and more. Autumn is an author herself. She is a screenwriter. She is a director. She is a publisher. She is a producer. She is a college professor. She is a public speaker. And she is not only doing all of this, but she's also reaching out to all of the diverse voices, all of the original voices, all of the people that have not yet gotten a seat at the table. She is reaching out for those voices because she has the wherewithal to give them that voice, to give them that stage, that podium, if you will. And that is definitely something to celebrate, especially in these crazy times. Not only is she doing all of this, but at the same time, she is also preparing her first animated short, which has a Seed and Spark campaign that you can donate to now called Infinity Care. And you can go to infinitycare.movie for those details. And we have Autumn here to tell us all about this and much more. So it is my pleasure to introduce my guest for this week, Autumn Karen. Autumn, how are you?
Thank you so much for having me and for that great intro, George. I'm tired just listening to it. So
I was tired just taking a look at the list of different things that you do. I know that there are some things that I myself do with the writing and the audiobook narrating, the podcasting, the voice acting, but this is just blowing my mind to see the amount of stuff that you've done and also to see all the different things that you're doing. I think that's wonderful.
Well, thank you. I come from a long line of women who never sat down. And so I am just another in a long line of women who never sit down. I am really lucky to have the privilege to be able to put all of this into creative outlets and to make these kinds of films and books and things. And this is stuff that, like, my grandmother and great grandmother could only dreamed of having these opportunities. So I'm just going to not let them go, George. I just want to, like, keep taking them.
So you are the living embodiment of Nevertheless, She Persisted.
Yes, that is absolutely it.
Excellent. Excellent. Yep. And we definitely have to dive in a little bit to something that I recently made a point to watch, and that was the teaser trailer to Infinity Care. And I got to tell you, if you're going to start recording or doing any sort of work or anything, give yourself a little bit after watching this, because it will wreck you. I just want to put that out there. It did for me, and I truly believe it will move a whole lot of people. And I hope that this discussion will prompt them to give a little bit and get this project off the ground, because I'm really excited for it.
Well, thank you so much for that, George. Infinity Care is, it is dark subject material. It's a sci-fi animated film inspired by the life and death of my daughter, who passed away from epilepsy when she was 3. Mm. And it's like an important story, and it's also a difficult story. We are very committed to making it with an unflinching eye for what this was really like and what this is like, not just for me, but lots of families. There are a lot of people who have lost children. Like, I'm not alone at all. But not everybody gets to have the platform to tell this story. So Infinity Care is very much a universal story about grief and hope. As dark as that trailer is, the film itself really does lean on this idea that you can dip your toe into grief and then you can step back out of it. Like, you don't have to stay there. So the film itself is really, it's a short film, 20 minutes long. It's complex. We pack a lot into that 20 minutes. My daughter had severe disability. She had Emanuel syndrome, which was like a very rare genetic disorder, and then epilepsy and a whole host of other things. And so we depict her in real life as she was in the film. And it's really beautiful. My animation team is working very hard at making sure that representation is right. We're partnering with C22C, which is a chromosomal advocacy group for the disorder that my daughter had.
And wow.
To make sure that we get that representation right, because even though she was my child and I can do that, Genesee, who is the little girl in the film, my daughter was Hermione, but Genesee is like meant to represent a lot more. And even for animators, animating a child with hypotonia, which is like low muscle tone, is different than animating a regular person. They spend all this time in school learning to animate, and they're having to unlearn some of that as we really work to make this little girl look accurate. And wow. We are in the film, we do go beat for beat through her death to a seizure, and it is beat for beat the same way that my daughter passed.
Oh my God.
So we're committed to showing that in an unflinching way. Epilepsy is hard, and it is difficult, but there's so much like violence and things on screen. There's so much hard things. This is really real. And again, it really does end on a hopeful note. The Jane, the mother in the film, comes at this with a sense of love, even though she is interacting with her kind of reanimated daughter, which is based on a dream. I had this recurring dream after Hermione died for many years, where I would go and visit her in this kind of like hospital, funeral home place. And like her coffin would open and I would like play with her in this recurring dream. And I wrote it down first as like a journal and then as a short story that I didn't share with anybody. And then I went back to film school in my 40s and ended up developing it into a short film thanks to my amazing mentor, Agatha Dominic, who's a powerhouse screenwriter. And I brought this as one of my ideas, one of like 10 ideas on the first day of screenwriting class. And she was like, that's the one that makes you, that's the one that hits you. That's the one you need to write. And it was a brutal 6 months to write the script and to really craft it into something that's not just kind of indulgent for me. It really is story driven so that the audience gets a satisfying arc. That we couldn't just tell, we had to amend the dream. We had to like do various things to make it a good story, like a good script, not just a good story, but like a good script that will make it. And animation was really important to me because, frankly, representing this kind of disability and epilepsy in live action, it's just not a way to do it ethically from my point of view. I also think that animation gives us the ability to reach a different audience. And also, like, it's about my little girl. And she really loved it. It's really amazing to see the characters of her in animation.
Feels like having gone through this project, seems like it would also be something very therapeutic. Did you notice that when you were doing it?
It is therapeutic, but I will say it's exposure therapy. Every time that we've had a reading, it's won several awards and has had public readings at several film festivals. And the pictures of me speaking on stage after that are just not pretty because I am pretty wrecked. And it turns into reliving her death every single time when I worked on the script and now when we're doing this. So it's therapeutic, absolutely, but I don't know that I would recommend it.
Well, it seems like you have to kind of relive those moments every time you're going through this, every daily that you're seeing, every different moment that you're seeing animated. And it's not like you can just stand up and walk out and just like, okay, I'm sure it's good. You have to make sure that it fits. Was just like you said, what it was, a very beat for beat moment. Like, that's brave, I would say, based on that. I think that's really something to be able to go through that.
Well, it is So it is something, it's also the question that the film asks. And the central, really the central question of Infinity Care is how much do we allow grief to take over our lives? And that's Jane, the protagonist, is really like struggling with when she goes to visit this place. So I'm going to talk about the plot, but that she goes to visit Infinity Care in this kind of futuristic setting. And she relives the memories of her and her daughter. And then she has this kind of extraordinary encounter with her daughter who is reanimated. And when she's reanimated, she comes back as a neurotypical child, which is something that I fought for. This is a big reason that we're making this as an independent film. I pitched this at South by Southwest last year, had folks interested in it, but they were not comfortable with specifically that part at the end where she comes back to life as a neurotypical child. And that's really, that is something for special needs parents that's important. And as I talk to special needs parents, this question of if you could make your child neurotypical, would you? So that's a big part of it. This question of how much does having a special needs child kind of overwhelm your life to the point that your other children can suffer. So Hermione, my daughter, I have three other kids. My oldest is about to go to college. I'm a single mom now. And so the question of how much does the grief eat up your life so that you are not present for your living children? And as a special needs parent, how much does that special needs child eat up your life so that your neurotypical children just don't get what they need? And that's really, that's a central question of the film, is like indulging in this. So it's funny, George, because even with Infinity Care, I am putting so much into this that my kids are like, I'm doing what Jane is doing in the movie to an extent, much of my heart and soul into this film. And it,
it makes a whole lot of sense. And that actually kind of rings true with the documentary that I recently saw, which was Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. And there's a section in there where they talk about that commercial that he did around like 98, 99 or so, where it talks about the advances in modern medicine and technology and what it could lead to. And it shows Christopher Reeve walking again. And they were saying how the disabled community really came down hard on that, because they were basically saying that, oh, we're just something to be cured. And so something like that, I think, would definitely, I can definitely see where the controversy would be.
I mean, it is that thing, and you can't help. And I actually just made a short video about this, but being a special needs parent is like this cascade of complex emotions. Fighting for your child, and you love your child as they are. And I am firm in that if Hermione were still alive, like I would change her diapers until I was 100 years old. Like there is not a question that I would take care of her, that I would be there for her, that my life is better with her in it. But even as my life was better with her in it, my life is patently easier without her. I could not have gone back to film school if I were taking care of her. There are so many things. And so there is this kind of survivor's guilt. And there's these complexities, because for everything, living life with challenges is challenging. And and I don't, those of us who kind of walk around and don't have those things, we really don't have any idea of the daily burden. And I had to say burden because it's not a burden.
It's difficult to really bring to other people's attention. But at the same time, it's one of those things where it feels like once you say it, you'll get that regret that you said it, but then at the same time, it's almost like a relief that you said it.
No, that's exactly it. And talking to other parents, my daughter had Emanuel syndrome, which is super rare. And I talked to other parents whose kids are still alive. And a lot of kids with Emanuel syndrome don't make it out of childhood, even though Hermione was very unexpected. She had been seizure free for 3 months when she, like we thought we were out of the woods. But it's just weird because you have to go make another life. And I really like lived in the grief for a long time. I'm a single mom now. I was married when Hermione was around. Having a special needs child and then the fallout from losing her, that is hard on relationships.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I just feel like as a society, now that I'm like on the other side and I'm not living with this and I have this energy, we could be, should be doing much more than we are. So mm-hmm. I think things that are happening now, like cuts to programs and things right now, that are going to hurt those families. And like their lives are so much harder than we think they are. And they don't ask for things. Especially mm-hmm. don't ask for things. They just get down and do it. So I just hate to see it. And it is complex, and technology is complex. And Hermione was a million-dollar kid, and she was only 3.5. When you talk about the amount of like funds and money and time it takes to support a child with complexities.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then my background is also, I have a master's degree in special education. So funnily enough, I had a child born with special needs right at the end of my master's in special ed.
Oh, wow.
Wow. So in terms of advocating and whatnot for kids and for families, and not just kids, like adults, what happens to special needs folks when they reach adulthood? And a lot of what happens is we put them in institutions and mm-hmm. hear from society. So
we have to get beyond that. Yeah.
We do. But I mean, we don't even live in walkable communities now. We don't have accessibility.
Like, yeah. I would be remiss if I didn't mention this, but my aunt and uncle are just real, you know, true warriors when it comes to all the things that they've had to deal with, because my youngest cousin has cerebral palsy and my oldest cousin, it's been 20 years since he passed away, but he had Wilms' tumor when he was 3 and the chemo stunted his growth and he went through a lot of issues throughout his life and got everything, seemed to get everything together and still never let anything stop him. Went on to be an Eagle Scout, went on to be a volunteer firefighter, went on to be an EMT and just like all of this stuff and got engaged and everything seemed to be doing just fine. And got his kidney from my other aunt and it was working. It was producing urine. Everything was doing great. And a 1 in a million issue that happened with his medication afterwards stopped his heart. And it's one of those things that 20 years later, it's still there. It still hangs there. And I feel like I was able to do a little bit of right by him by naming the main character in my young adult sci-fi trilogy after him, because he was always my hero. And so.
And I am sorry to hear that your family lived with that. There's a thing with losing a child where you don't ever fill the hole. You learn to live with it. Right. Mm-hmm. And I feel for your aunt and uncle, it's never okay.
Yeah. Okay. So definitely everyone, please donate to the Seed and Spark campaign. It's telling an important story and it's something that needs to be out there, but I definitely feel the need to pivot a little bit more and get to know more of you yourself as this well-rounded individual, someone who is creating all these different venues to bring voice to the voiceless. So first of all, I'm curious to know, like, where did this road to creativity start for you when it came to all these different things? You said you went to film school in your 40s, but at the same time, was writing always a part of that? Was that always something that you wanted to do at the beginning?
So no, I got my master's in special ed. I mm-hmm. had an undergraduate in women's studies and I was a middle school special ed teacher and I was very pragmatic. I had 4 kids and they needed to eat and school teachers don't make a lot of money. And I was the sole source of income for our family. Mm-hmm. So I started writing lesson plans online to make extra money while I was teaching full time.
Oh, wow.
From writing lesson plans, that turned into like blogs to go with the lesson plans, and that turned into more blogs, and that turned into ebooks, and that turned into books. And that's how I became a professional ghostwriter. I started out my college career wanting to be an actress. That was like the original plan, was to be on Broadway.
Oh, no kidding. I actually got a theater degree, and it was during that's when I kind of like fell back in love with writing. So had a feeling that was where I was going to go. So that's wild that you wanted to be an actress back then.
I did want to be an actress. And I think that there's a level of hustle. I definitely have the hustle. There's a level of hustle to acting that just never was quite right. And I also got married very young and that kind of changed things. Fast forward to when I had kids and I was writing books And it was all really just for the money of it. Very pragmatic. And that's still, to a degree, what it is for me, although I do really enjoy the writing that I do for clients now. I wrapped 3 books last year. One I'm technically wrapping this year because I just got the last little piece that I needed to finish one chapter. Mm-hmm. But I write at volume because I have to. And so it's really when you're looking at, you have to pay the mortgage to keep the roof over the head of the kids. And that's still kind of the hustle that I have. But I had been ghostwriting for many years and ended up making enough money as a ghostwriter to leave my job as a teacher and was actually home for the last year of Hermione's life, which was really like a gift to be able to be at home with her. And then, like, after I got divorced and moved to a different city, I ended up being offered a job to teach ghostwriting.
Oh, wow.
And in the university like setting, I did not have an MFA, didn't have a terminal degree. I needed a terminal degree in order to progress any further as a professor. And I had always loved film. And so it's like one of those like dreams. So the little town I grew up in, the idea of making movies was just like, that was not possible. Yeah. You might be like, go be an astronaut. Like, that's not possible. And so I ended up applying to film school as kind of an older person. And part of it is my kids got older. I would not have been able to go to film school when they were younger. Mm-hmm. So my youngest son was like 9 when I went to film school, and he's 12 now. But it was, they were at an age where my mom could come and stay with them a couple of nights a week, and they didn't suffer for it because kids always have to come first.
Of course.
Yeah. So then I went to film school as an adult with all these books under my belt. And that's the first time that I wrote for myself, because ghostwriting is all about subsuming your ego for someone else, right? You're like delving into their story. You're capturing, mm-hmm. this, you're talking as them. And I knew that I needed to find my own voice. Infinity Care is actually the first film script that I ever wrote. And so that's kind of, that's its own journey. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I just love filmmaking. I really love the collaborative nature of it. Filmmaking is collaboration, like, on a whole nother level. And I just love every part of it. Like Infinity Care, I love producing it. The films I've produced previously, I just love the collaboration.
Now, when you say the ones you produced previously, was that all under the banner of Medusa's Gaze Films?
So Medusa's Gaze Films actually came out of our frustration with reading so many scripts by straight white men in our film program. And that's all we read. So we were so frustrated kind of with the industry where it was. And a group of us ended up making a film that was, we got grant funded for a short film, and we made a film called The Women of Acadia Street that was only women and gender diverse folks in front of and behind the camera.
Nice. And
yeah. And it was these series of vignettes about women's invisible labor. Mm-hmm. Really fun. Had a great experience on set with everybody. And then out of that, that's where Medusa's Gaze came from. So Women of Acadia Street, it was made by a lot of the same people. But then 4 of us came together to form this company. And here we are. We're actually launching a film contest, which is live on Film Freeway right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I love Film Freeway.
Oh, there you go. So it's called the Women Talking to Women About Something Besides a Man Film Contest.
That is awesome. I love that.
Yeah. So it's linked on our website, medusasgazefilms.com. And we just launched that. So, I mean, the title says it all. It's open, mm-hmm. to people of all genders. Like, we're not concerned about who is writing it. There's no gatekeeping there. But we do want to hear things that pass the Bechdel test. So we have lots of big plans for that. Infinity Care itself will have 75% women and gender diverse folks behind the camera in development. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of our benchmark. That's our seal of real representation.
Yeah. The
representation in Hollywood and in storytelling in general is, it ain't pretty.
No, it's not. You know, it's not. But at the same time, there are people like yourself, like your company, that are presenting a lot of opportunities for people that otherwise wouldn't have had it.
that's what we're trying to do. And we see a lot of independent films made. It is not for the faint of heart. And I'll put out another shout out for our crowdfunding for Infinity Care. It is challenging to raise funds, but we're committed to doing it. In our company, we've got a really fantastic person who has tons of experience and has made lots of independent films. Their work is fantastic. Stephen Victoria Stone, they're amazing. Another one of our partners, Mary Craven Adams, is an attorney, and she is on the Board of Entertainment Attorneys here in North Carolina. So we're also a fantastic screenwriter. I mean, just amazing.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And then Ellie is she is a cinematographer. And so we have a really like wonderful group of people. And then our first real piece is animation, which none of us have made before. But I have an amazing animation director, Abby Davenport, who is leading the way on Infinity Care and making that beautiful trailer that you saw. So
it really is gorgeous. It looks like it would stand alongside the different things that you would see on the Saturday night anime block on Adult Swim back in the day of the Cartoon Network. But it was really something. I was very impressed when I saw that.
Well, thank you all so much. The trailer is on YouTube and you can find it right on infinitycare.movie. I'm really, really proud of that. An original score by Lavelle Curtis. So we're really trying to bring those diverse voices in. It does matter. It matters with what's on the front end, which comes to my work as a ghostwriter. I've written 28 books in the last 12 years. They are mostly for privileged men. I think 28 books, I've probably written 4 for women.
That's so sad to get that. Like that, the guys would be just like, I need someone else to tell my story. And it's like, you're able to tell your own story, sir. with a lot of things like that, this is what it feels like.
Well, I will say, in my experience, this is my experience across the board working with women and people of color whose books I've written, is the power dynamics are significant in the world of writing. It does take a certain amount of bravado to write a book about yourself and a certain amount of like, this is my story and it deserves to be told. Right. The women are less willing to put their stories out there, right? And it takes a lot to put money behind something, and I am not cheap. So in order to pay tens of thousands of dollars to have your book written, first of all, you have to have that money, that kind of disposable income.
Yeah.
And you have to have a reason to do it, because everybody I've worked with who's written a book has some kind of platform that they're trying to promote. So yeah, that's its own thing, man. I go deep into the ethics of ghostwriting in my classes, and I actually have a book coming out later this year with Kendall Hunt that's going to be about the art of ghostwriting. Like, it's in progress, and I'm actually really proud of that book.
I appreciate that you said that you're not cheap, because I remember hearing, what is the phrase? If I don't have a margin, I can't afford a mission. So I need a margin to go forth in the mission. And that's something that a lot of people really need to grasp. It's one thing to make sure that your services are at a level where as many people as possible can take part in it. But at the same time, if you're not able to pay your own bills while you're making yourself super cheap, then you're basically overworking yourself and you're underpaying yourself. So if you have the capability to spread yourself to a point where you can take on so many different projects at once, then that means you're worth that extra money.
It really is. And it's hard, because the thing is, when you do increase your value like that, you get a lot more no's. Mm-hmm. And so it takes a bunch of meetings for me to land a book that I, first of all, want to write, because there are books that I turn down. Mm-hmm. And then it's a lot of people like look at the price tag and they're like, I can't do that, which is fine. But like, I have to, like, it has to be worth my time. I could write a bunch of books for less. That's time away from my kids, and that's time away from my own creative endeavors. And I've also been doing this for a very long time and teaching it for a very long time. So I'm good at what I do. But yeah, that all is very much a challenge. I will say that I have discounted my rate for people whose stories I really believe in.
Yeah.
And so that's actually, if I talk to somebody who, especially somebody from a marginalized community who cannot afford me then I have written books for several clients at a discount because I'm like, this story needs to be told. And so part of it is your own like emotional capital. And so I'm not spending as much emotional capital on those books because I'm so passionate about the project that it's easier to write. And so it actually takes me less time. So it's a discount and it's like that whole thing.
And I know what you mean when it comes to discounting your rates, because I've done that before with my longtime client for his audiobooks. And I enjoy working with him. I feel like the more I work with him, the better I get as an audiobook narrator in general. And he likes my style. I will take a discount. We will negotiate the rates. And I'm glad to do that because he has invested so much time in me. This is going to be my 7th book that I'm doing with him now. So that is something that does not go over lightly with me. I take that very, very seriously. These are the people that are giving me opportunities to allow me to do what I love to do. As an audiobook narrator, there are opportunities, just like with voice acting, where you can audition for different things. Since you mentioned the different projects that you've gotten that have come your way that you've either said no to or they've said no to you, or you've discounted your rate in order to work with them, what is the process for getting a ghostwriter job? Is there some sort of an audition process with that?
So ghostwriting is kind of it's a freelance field. I mean, like that's what it is. A lot of ghostwriters are journalists most of the ghostwriters who I know started out as journalists. And I'm a journalist myself. Like I've done a lot of that work as well. But if you want to be a ghostwriter, I always tell people the way that I started was freelancing online. So I started, it was actually Elance, which dates me because I don't think it's been Elance since like 2010.
Oh, wow.
But Upwork is a huge platform. Mm. LinkedIn is where there's a lot of writing jobs, but that is the case. I really worked for very little money for a long time and kind of honed my skills. It's embarrassing the amount of money that I've taken for books at times when I needed to pay the bills. I would encourage people to, first of all, start writing yourself. That's not the path that I took, but I think that's a good way to go, whether it's on a platform like Medium or Substack, but starting to like really put yourself out there and develop a voice. That's really important. And then also just going and seeking like ghostwriting jobs on those platforms like Upwork.
And was it this kind of writing that led you to eventually go with starting your own imprint with Woven Lines?
It was. So Woven Lines came about because I have a lot of clients who I do have clients who query. I've had clients who landed with traditional publishers. I will say that at least one of the clients who landed with a traditional publisher and got offered a lot of money, got offered a 6-figure deal from a publisher.
Oh, wow.
Them down, which hurt me because I had a cut of the back end of their book.
Oh, no.
Turned them down because they would lose the rights and they were not willing to give up the life rights to their story. In terms of Woven Lines, that came about because people are always asking me if I would publish their stuff. And so that they didn't have to go the self-publishing route. What I am wary of with Woven Lines, because I have worked for hybrid publishers before and they are a scam. I've worked with hybrid publishers. I've worked for vanity presses before. I'm not interested in being a vanity press.
Right.
I'm interested in telling really important stories. So Woven Lines is, we're publishing this fall. We're going to publish the memoir of a client that I worked with who was a healthcare leader, and her book is fantastic. And I read that book several years ago, but I'd like for me to republish it. So that's kind of where we're going with that. I am new to publishing, but I'm also distribution is distribution. Mm-hmm. And if everybody I know who has worked with major publishers has to market it themselves anyway.
That is true. Sadly. Yeah. And so with everything that you do, with all the different venues that you've chosen to indulge in and really excel in from what we've discussed, say there is someone who feels like they have something bubbling within them, something creative, but they feel like they can't properly amplify it. They can't find their the proper stage of where they need to be. What is it that you would suggest that they do first? Would it be just like just writing out the story that's in their head and seeing where it goes?
So I will say the support is, that is my suggestion, is to find methods of support. Now that can be a writing coach, and like people can book like coaching sessions with me on my website, but you don't need necessarily a writing coach. You don't have to pay for it. Go find yourselves a writing group. Go find people to share your story with that will help you move it forward. One thing that does not happen is creativity in isolation. Not creativity done. You have to have accountability of some kind. So like my poor writing students, that like if you go look at my Rate My Professor, what everybody says is you write so much. Like there's so much writing. Do you have a high bar for the word counts that I require of students? Because that's what pushes you to like actually do something. So don't keep it in the dark. Whatever you're doing, like there's Reddit forums. You can go on and find places to talk to people. You can hire a writing coach. You can go take a class in writing. You can join writing groups. There's a writer's group in the town that I live in that's really wonderful. Mm-hmm. Like, that's my biggest suggestion, is to not try to do it yourself, because it's not going to happen. Like, I love all you, every single one of you listening. It's not going to happen if you just try to like muscle it yourself. You need to bounce ideas off of people and hear what works and what doesn't. And it is very much true that writing is rewriting. So whatever you get down first, you have to understand that that's the first iteration.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
Everywhere I am at Autumn Carrying, like I'm carrying something. That's a very old.
Very nice.
Autumn Carrying everywhere, and then Infinity Care Movie if you're looking for that. But yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. And again, I cannot stress enough just how important it is to have someone like Autumn Karen in your corner, someone who is looking for those people that have not been able to sit down at the table, but then at the same time, don't want to sit. So by all means, get to the table and keep standing while you're there, because everyone needs to be heard. All these wonderful voices that have yet to find their support system, that have the stories in them, but have yet to be able to get it out there. You have people like Autumn that are rooting for you, that want to support you, that want to give you that platform. So take these opportunities that are there. Go on Film Freeway, find that writing contest. And by all means, whatever you need to do to get your stories in these crazy times, we need your stories and your voices now more than ever. So please support Autumn by going to the Seed and Spark campaign. Go to infinitycare.movie. Go to her website, autumncaren.com, and learn more about what it is that she does. Learn more about what she is doing. Learn more about what she is offering. It's all right there for you. This is the time to grab those opportunities while they are there. So for Autumn Karen, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to he'sgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to george@he'sgotit.com.